Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. You know, once again, today we are about to enter into a discussion that is not possibly so uncommon, yet it is so profound that it really has impacted my life and the way I am viewing the concept of story as opposed to fact-telling. My special guest today is Richard Stone, author of Story Intelligence, and he is an expert in the power of story. His book breaks the barrier between the value of facts and the immersive and life-changing impact of real stories. In Richard's mind, and I really have come to believe this, each of us is the sum of the story we tell about ourselves. We are not the sum of our life experiences. We are not the sum of our cognitive conclusions. We have stories. We have experiences that make our lives what they are today. In fact, Richard convinced me that my life has been more an accident of me telling my story, buying my story, and living according to my story. But it can be altered once reevaluated. Richard and I talk about how you can do that, how you can use story to motivate your life, move your life, and even change your life. So join me with author Richard Stone in his book Story Intelligence on the power of story to change your life. Rick Stone, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie. Boy, I tell you, I am really excited about our conversation today.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, it's you know, this whole concept of story intelligence is really, boy, after our conversation earlier this week, you really got me thinking, and I've been pondering this subject. And so, Rick, instead of a lot of times in my shows, we have sort of introductory banter about life, the universe, and everything. And I want to do this show a bit differently. And I want to jump right into this, to the subject of story. I think you have so much to say, and I don't want to waste any time. You possess what I call an undeniably truthful view of life and the essential nature of life story. You have convinced me, as much as anything else, the essence of our life and of our business life is communicated by story even more than facts. And we live in a world that loves facts, but facts don't motivate, don't inspire, don't sell. Why do you think that story is so much more important than just a list of facts and successes and failures or whatever?
Well, it has a lot to do with our history going back probably hundreds of thousands of years. And we've been sitting around fires for a long time, especially in the winter months. And what do? Is we tell about the events of what happened that day and what we observed and what we experienced. And I think that probably our brains evolved in such a way that they are keyed into story. And in fact, there's a lot of research that's suggesting our brains are literally wired for story. And so human beings are immediately connected to story. And, you know, one of the things I say to people, I say, if I say once upon a time the cow jumped over the moon, no one jumps up and objects. I don't care. Even if I have a panel of scientists and engineers sitting in front of me, no one says, wait a second, you know, cows can't jump over the moon. They can't much less jump over a fence, you know, or how would they breathe up there? They ask, well, what happened next? And so our brain is hungry for story. And if you look around, it's not surprising that the entertainment business is so successful, and billions, maybe even trillions of dollars of business is done in the making of and buying of stories. And what do? Is we have time off, we immediately immerse ourselves in a story, whether it's reading a book or watching a movie or whatever it is. We're keyed in for story. And there's a suggestion that our brain is actually, if you think of the software of the brain, our brain is actually waiting to hear a story. And there's a thing called narrative schema. And just, you know, quite simply, it's the structure of a story. You know, there's an initial event, and the setting is described, and there's a statement of a goal by a protagonist, or there's a problem that's created, and the protagonist responds to that problem, and then there's complicating action, whereas maybe they solve that problem, it leads to a bigger problem, and then finally there's a resolution and a reaction to the outcome. Our brain is looking for that. And if we don't give it to the brain wanders off somewhere else. If those of you who sat through lectures in college or whatever, if we were able to somehow meter and look at how much people are really attending to what's being said, probably there, if we could see people are thinking, oh gosh, did I leave the stove on this morning when I walked out the door? And how am I going to manage picking up the kids at 5 o'clock and then getting the dry cleaning and also buying dinner? And, we're off all over the place. But if the person in front of us is telling a story, none of that happens. We're absorbed. So we have to understand this is the way we're wired. We see our lives as a story. Every business and organization, it has a story, whether they recognize it or not, whether the leaders embrace that or not. And the more we begin to really come to grips with the fact that we are storied creatures, and that's what defines us, I think the better off we'll be, because once we understand that, then we're better equipped to be not only creators of stories and good stories that can be impactful in our lives, but also we can be better discerners of stories and consumers of stories, and not necessarily hear a story and immediately accept it prima facie that it's a true story. So that becomes, I think, a crucial skill set. And that's why we say that we have story intelligence, is that because of this, and because we are so attuned to this phenomenon of story, those who are more conscious of it and more intentional, I think, can be more effective and probably more successful with their lives.
You know, it's really...
That's a long-winded answer there.
No. But it was very... insightful. It's funny when I do shows like this, and when I'm doing a professional sort of speaking, I lean away from story and I lean more to the facts. Here's what we're doing. This is mm-hmm. Asking intellectual questions. But when I think about my personal life, I just spent the week with my son in Cleveland, who is from San Diego but lives in Cleveland right now, and so much of our conversation is about story. He's a baseball player, and so he's telling me stories of things that are going on in the field, and I'm telling him stories, and you think our conversation. I wonder what percentage have you researched this? What percentage of our conversation is story as opposed to facts?
Well, I'd say it's very high, actually. The notion of sharing facts and information and data, that's something that somehow we've become convinced in the world of business that that's the way you convince people, is give them enough data and information to convince them. And the truth is that's not very effective, and there's a lot of research on that, for example. There was a study done where they were looking at new breakthroughs in medicine and the adoption of evidence-based practices by doctors. And so the question was, if doctors have been around for a while, they've been doing the same procedure for a long time, they're very comfortable with it, how do you get them on board to consider doing something new and different? And that's always the case with most of us. How do we change our behavior and the way we see things? And So they gave one group of doctors the data, that this new procedure was much more effective. Uh-huh. They gave another group of doctors just a story about a physician who adopted the new practice and was having tremendous success. and his patients were doing better, and or her patients were doing better. And then the third group, they gave the data and a story. So which do you think was the most effective at getting people to change their behavior and adopt the new procedure?
Oh, you're putting me in a position here.
Yeah.
You know, my logic says the data and the story.
What logical brains?
My logic says the data and the story. My intuition says the story.
Yeah, you're right. Your intuition is right. The story was more effective. And what's interesting, because I know you've been involved with a nonprofit for a long time, and you probably go out and raise money to support the efforts of your work. There's a guy named Paul Slovic who started doing research on why people give money to nonprofits, to charities, for causes. Paul Slovic, S-L-O-V-I-K. You ought to look him up. And so, you know, our intuition is, let's say, you know, there's a famine in Darfur, and every day 3,000 children are going hungry or dying from the famine, and we think that that's all, one, it's distressing, and two, we think that would be compelling to get people to write a check or hand over their credit card number. And what he found was that actually what was more effective is the story of one child. So this is what I refer to as the universal in the particular. So the story of one child who is hungry and who is suffering from what's going on with whatever it is, whether it's a famine or there's war or whatever it is, that is compelling. And I don't know why it is, but for us human beings, if we start hearing that 80 million people tomorrow will be going hungry around the world, we are overwhelmed by that number.
Yeah.
We can't.
What does it mean? It's really almost a meaningless number.
Well, yeah. How do I connect to it? It doesn't connect to my heart. It's connecting to my head. And giving money to support charities is an emotional decision. So Paul Slovic found is that when if it's an ad in the newspaper, it's a picture of this child, and there's a headline as that, will you help this young boy today have food? Just that image elicits an emotional response from us. It goes right to our heart, and we want to help. Because I think human beings, we naturally want to help others, but we get overwhelmed. We get totally overwhelmed when we have to face these large numbers. And in fact, if you have the picture of the child and then below put data, it actually, those ads pull less donations. Because what that does is it confounds us. We suddenly then get mired in the numbers, and it reduces our emotional response.
Really?
So the same is true in how do we engage others with changing their mind about something. There's so much out there today that we know is not true, but people have embraced these stories, these fantastic, ridiculous stories, and they think they're true. And we think we just give them enough data, or you know, we'll set them straight. And the brain does a very funny thing, though, is if we believe something, if we've taken in a story, you know, hook, line, and sinker, and digested it, it kind of sets up shop and sets out little tentacles and begins to kind of get rooted in our consciousness. And giving that person data and information actually has the opposite effect. People sort of double down, you know, on that. They dig in deeper. And so the only way, I think, to the only antidote to people who somehow have gone off and believe something that's just way off base is to tell them another story that is in some ways the story itself carries within it the contradiction to what they're believing. Now they have to grapple with this one instance that doesn't jive with their current belief. And it gives them pause to reconsider and rethink.
You know, you lead me to two stories, and one is that in our charity, we just hired in Uganda a Ugandan storyteller. And what his job is to go to village communities that have just received water or have not yet received water and get stories from children, moms, and dads, and then convey those stories so we can come back. And we have a monthly publication titled The Well, and there's always a story from someone in Uganda that's telling the story of how the water has actually changed their lives and impact their lives. And
the family whose life is profoundly transformed by this simple thing called a well, that it completely opens up possibilities for them that they would never have seen. That's inspiring. And a story about a family whose life is terribly limited because they have to walk 5 miles to get water or whatever it is, you know. Those stories will impact people and open their hearts to want to help.
Yeah, I'm looking for this story that I was going to send you a story, so I have to get off of it. But it was really a wonderful story by a dad, a 59-year-old granddad, who did the 5-mile walk himself because he was afraid his children would not be able to go to school. There's danger of sexual assault.
Right.
There's, you know, and the danger of the animals. And so he did it himself. And so he would walk, you know, 2 to 5 miles a day for water, 59-year-old man, to take care of his children. And this was, you know, it was such a moving story. It was one of the best, you know, I sent to our producers saying it's one of the best stories we've produced. You know, and another story that's offline, but off wells. It's not offline, but I have a friend who's an attorney, is a retired attorney, and he's taken 250 cases to jury trial. I mean, and there's, you know, that's really rare that you have.
That's a lot.
That's really a lot. I mean, 25 is considered a lot. If you took 25 cases to trial, that's considered a lot. He's taken 250, and he's a brilliant man, and he does not believe in white privilege, and he wrote a 7-page document on why racism is not as big an issue as we're trying to make it in the country. And I want to tell you, written from facts, written just from logic, it is one of the most convincing arguments I've read. I mean, you know, it's a terribly convincing argument, but my response was at the end, said it's a very convincing argument, but it's wrong. And I said, and you're missing one thing. And he says, what's that? And I didn't say story. I said, you didn't put a face on it. Anytime you put a face on your logical expose, you change everything. Everything is different. If there's a face, if there's a person, if there's a story involved, then your facts don't really mean a whole lot, because now you're talking about the lives of a human being. And he was very gracious, and he said, you know, and he says, man, I've not thought about that. I really have to ponder that. But it's the difference between facts and a life story, a life event that really seems to get to the depth of what we're doing. I'm curious. I got another question for you. You are obviously, story is your keen interest these days. Was there a story or events in your life that led you to take on story as an impetus for your personal and business lives?
Yeah. I think there's, you know, in the parlance of stories and in the language of stories, sometimes, you know, stories often have an event or a turning point. It's something that,
right,
that intercedes in the person, in the character's life, that suddenly, if that hadn't happened. And I had such an event for myself. I was flying back from a hiking trip out west. I used to do a lot of hiking with an old friend, and we used to do at least one big trip a summer, you know, 10 days out in the wilderness. And I was coming back from the trip, and there were two people seated next to me. They were a couple, and they were hikers. So, you know, there's, you know, we're talking about various trails we've seen and hiked. And And at some point they said, have you ever been to the National Storytelling Festival? And I kind of just shrugged. I said, what's that? I have no idea. I never heard of such a thing. And it's in Jonesboro, Tennessee, which is in the northeast corner of Tennessee, just over the mountains from Asheville, North Carolina. And at the time, I had been working with an organization called the Foundation for Mideast Communication that was attempting to get Jews and Arabs in a room together to get to know each other, to tell each other stories, and hopefully build connections and relationships. And when I look back on that, a lot of what we were doing was storytelling. I and another friend, Haiti Schleifer, we used to do little fundraisers and things, and we would often MC them and yuck it up. And this would have been back in the spring. Somebody said to us, you know, you guys are so funny. You ought to do an evening of comedy. And we agreed to do that. And we spent our whole summer working on our best jokes. And come August, I invited a good friend of mine over who had a lot of theater background. I said, hey, Bob, would you come over and just around the dining table and sort of walk through what we're going to do and give us your feedback? And when we got done, he looked at us. He said, don't do this. You will embarrass and humiliate yourself. So we're sitting there looking at each other. And now this event is scheduled for the Sunday after Thanksgiving. There was a nightclub in Winter Park, Florida, where I lived. And they had agreed to give us the nightclub. And we had a committee that was working on selling out the place that seated 250 people. And I said, well, Haiti, I have no clue. Let's sleep on it. And I had met these people, and I subsequently went to the festival. This is the first weekend in October. And I'm sitting in the audience, and a storyteller from Minnesota, a farmer, a guy named Michael Cotter, is telling stories about that farm and the things he's witnessed in his lifetime and the changes that had happened and just sometimes small, very touching little tales. And I had an epiphany. I was sitting there with a friend of mine who was a writer who wrote for a magazine in Orlando. He had come along. And I said, Karin, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. And at the time, I was running an advertising agency and had been burned out, and it actually was up for sale. So, but when I came back, I said to my friend Haiti, I said, what we need to do is tell our life stories. We need to make this an evening of storytelling. And she immediately said, yes. And
there's comedy in that. And
some of them were very funny.
Yeah.
and some were touching. There's a story. And we created two characters. One was my grandfather. It was sort of a composite of my grandfather's. And called him Morris Zavitsky. And hers was Edna Zippelbaum.
What great names. You couldn't make up better names.
And the evening was called Stick and Stone. And I would change character. I just had like a coat rack on the stage, and I would put on this old wool kind of sport coat and put a little cap on my head and sort of bring my glasses down sort of lower on my nose, get a little hunched over so I was a little older. And one of the stories I told, when I was growing up, I was always heard the story that my grandfather George stole his brother's ticket to come to America. And I always thought that was just remarkable. And unfortunately, I never sat down with him while he was still living and said, George, tell me about that. Did you really steal your brother's ticket? And so George was long gone and died many years previously. And no one knew the story. But what I did was I created a story imagining what it must have been like for George at age 13, listening to his brother come home every day talking about America. And in America, you could be somebody, you know. And who were they? They were living in a little village in Poland somewhere, you know, nothing. You know, and my grandfather was very European. I never saw my grandfather not wearing a tie and a coat. He could be out weeding in the yard, and he'd have a coat and tie on. The guy was very, very proper. And there's this custom in Europe of drinking, taking a cube of sugar and putting it between your teeth while you drink your tea. And that's what he would do. And so I imagine his brother would say, you know, in America, you can have a cube of sugar with every cup of tea. Can you imagine that? So when his brother came home one day and he had finally earned enough money and bought his ticket and left it there on the mantle. I imagine George couldn't help himself. He'd been filled with stories about America, and he just desperately wanted to go there, and he took the ticket early in the morning before his brother woke up and stole away in the dark of the morning and took a came to America. You know, families are all filled with very interesting, sometimes bizarre stories. The question is, what happened to his brother? And it turns out, my uncle Sonny told the story that there was a man who lived. George went on, no education. He came here at 13, went on to be a very successful businessman, and ended up buying a business in Lima, Ohio, a janitorial business that during the Depression was so successful that he even had a driver for a car. And so there was a man who lived above the building where the business was housed, who sort of was like the super of the building. You know, he took care of the building. And when that man died, my uncle discovered that it was his uncle. It was George's brother. Now,
amazing.
Who knows?
Yeah,
who knows what that was about? You know, he came to America. Maybe he couldn't make it in America. George was embarrassed or ashamed of him. We'll never know. So, you know, that was a life-changing event for me. That was the beginning of my foray into story. My business sold soon after that. And I remember sitting down with my dad, and I said, "Dad, I'm selling the business, and I'm going to pursue a career in storytelling." And he looked like I had just, like,
of course,
fallen out of bed and hit my head or something. You know,
yeah.
He couldn't believe me.
But you know, Rick, there is the truth that there's such, you know, storytelling, you know, consists of such defining exercises, and that I don't know if you mentioned it or I thought of it, but it was, in essence, each of us are precisely what we tell ourselves are. We are. We are what we tell tell ourselves we are. And if we tell ourselves we're successful or that we're happy and that we're content with life, then we tend to be. But when we tell ourselves those other stories, if you will, then they ring true just as much. And so we can, by creating a story of our life, we can, in essence, create a change or a better life. Would you agree with that?
Oh, totally. Totally. You know, I think stories either, they define us, and they either animate possibilities or they do limit us in profound ways. And unfortunately, we're often living inside that story. And it may not even be a story of our making, our own making. Maybe it's a story that we digested or ingested from our parents. We were told that we would never be smart enough to do something or whatever. And pretty soon that story gets wired in, hardwired in. And it's the way we see ourselves. It's the way we see the world. And we don't even know that we're living inside that story. That story has really become a prison for us. So that's why we have to become conscious of the notion that we are living and breathing within stories, and it's incumbent upon us to unearth those. We talk a lot about treasures and trash. So I think in our past we have lots of treasures. There are lots of stories that are really, we want to embrace and hold on to because they embody goodness and all kinds of positive traits. But along the way, we acquire some trash unwittingly sometimes, and it takes up shop. And so there's a wonderful author, last name Sam Keen, in this concept he has. He said the word author and authority have very similar roots, right? So whoever authors your story has authority or power in your life. And so often we're living a story that we didn't even author. And so it becomes an incumbent upon us to begin to ask the question, well, where did that story come from? Is it true? How do I know it's true? You know, what evidence do I have that I'm not smart enough?
I'm fond of telling the story of my early childhood. It was a difficult early childhood, and It impacted me later on, and I wanted to tell you about a story of what I consider my 20s. I call it the dark decade. I was at UCLA. I was on a full scholarship in gymnastics. You know, I was kind of like the bright and shining child. You know, I did well in education, but I was a little bit of a rebel. You know, I had this craziness from my childhood, and those, I call it the dark decade because they were decade of sex and drugs and rock and roll. It was in the 70s. So, you know, you can imagine what was going on. I was a full scholarship athlete that quit to become a full-time hippie. But, you know, in those dark days and times of getting in trouble, I look back at those days, and I've for so long, Rick, looked back at those days as saying, oh, what I could have been had I done something else those days. But you know what I experienced in those days? I experienced total freedom. I hitchhiked around the country for 3 months. I had little stress. And if something sounded good or fun to do, I just did it. And so it was like my brother-in-law teased me, says, you kids are different than we are. You know, we believe in working long and retiring, and you believe in retiring and then working long. And, in some ways, I'll look back on those hippie days that I robbed myself of some professional development, but the lessons I learned are irreplaceable. It made me very attentive to needs that come from the depths of my soul. And I'm not so sure this is common. I can hear, you know, I have great communication with my soul and with my inner thoughts and with my intuition. And it is not always logical, but there are times it tells me this is right, this is what you should do. And I think I learned that during those dark years. So that story of those dark years is not just a story of dark years. It's a story of one heck of a lot of fun and freedom, little stress, and having a good time. You know, it was, and then, you know, you add to it the getting in trouble, but, you know, that's what makes the story even more fun.
But you wouldn't be who you are today if you hadn't done that. You'd be somebody else.
Hadn't we agreed on that? Hey. That, you know, I think I told a friend of mine during this last week that even our darkest days, we played the cards we were dealt, and they define, I would not be who I am today were it not for those days. I would be a different person.
Yeah. So there's a concept of, in the world of reminiscence, there's a whole taxonomy of reminiscence. It's called integrative reminiscence. And what that means, if you think of your life as a book, and that every phase of your life is a chapter in the book, so that's a chapter, those early 20s when you were, you know, doing all kinds of wild things. And then the question becomes, do you excise one chapter because, you know, maybe there was something difficult or painful to do there? Or do you take a look at it as a story of what happened and, oh, isn't that interesting? Because if I hadn't been doing that, then that wouldn't have led to this decision and over here, and I wouldn't have met this person, or I may not have met my spouse, or I may not have, you know. So it's easy sometimes to look with regret on the past and to regret decisions, but we can also look at it and say, oh, okay, I see how I made that decision. Oh, I see that. Okay, but I see how it fits in the tapestry of who I am.
Precisely, the tapestry that's being woven in pieces. It's not being woven in a sort of a consecutive order. It's, you know, the middle, the sides, and the
it's not your typical story of, you know, I went to school, I got my degree, I went and got a job, I worked my whole life, and had two kids, and now I have three grandkids, and And I'm retired now, and I get to play golf all day or something like that. You know,
tell me,
what a boring life.
You know, with that, and I don't know how this fits, but does the axe in the knee story fit in this context right here?
The axe in the knee story. Well, you know, so maybe I should tell that story so people have some context.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah, it is a wonderful story. So there's this notion about story, that story can be transformative. And sometimes things happen to us. We have an illness that suddenly happens, or an accident occurs that is life-changing in some profound way. And we can spend a lot of time bemoaning that, or we can move with it. So there's a wonderful storyteller named Donald Davis, who's from North Carolina. He lives on the Outer Banks. There's an old saying in the world of storytelling that the best-known storyteller is less well-known than the least-known soap opera star. You know, the paparazzi are following them around in the airport to get their picture. But Donald is probably in the pantheon of living storytellers, really, at the top of his craft. But he tells a story about his father, who in 1905 was 5 years old, and his dad and brothers were making shake shingles, and they're using a lot of sharp tools, small axes, and all kinds of stuff like that, and he desperately wanted to be a part of the experience, and they kept on sort of waving him off, saying, "You're too young, you're going to get hurt." And when his mother called for dinner around 1 o'clock, that's, you know, very Southern dinner, at one, everybody went in, but he helped.
Oh, yeah, you have dinner and supper.
Yeah, so when everyone went around the corner, he pulled that little axe that they'd been using out of where it had been sort of left in a tree stump, and started chopping on all kinds of things. And after a few minutes, they noticed he wasn't there, and they called out again for him to come to dinner. And he went to put that little axe back in the tree trunk, and it bounced. He missed, and it bounced off the trunk and buried itself in his knee. That's how they found him. And so his dad wrapped him up and got on a horse. They didn't have a car, and rode a few miles to the town doctor, and who took one look and just sort of shook his head and had never seen a wound that bad. So I think we're going to have to take his leg off. And his father just shook his head, so I don't think so. And rode on into town to the train station. And said, "When's the next train coming, and where's it going?" He said, "Well, you just missed the train to Asheville," which at that time was a pretty big town, and they were in eastern North Carolina. And I said, "But you know, the next train is going to Murphy, and you can connect with the Southern line and go to Atlanta." And that's what he did. And in 1905, Grady Hospital, which is the tertiary care hospital right in downtown Atlanta, had just been built. And they got his son down there. He got Joe down there and saved his life. And when he got home, he was deeply depressed because they had to remove his kneecap. So he was going to walk with a limp, you know, a stiff leg for the rest of his life. And his mother every day made him tell the story of what happened. He didn't want to do that, but she forced him to. And she said, "Now, Joe, tell the story from the point of view of the doctor and what he learned at Grady Hospital." And the next day she might say, "Tell the story from the point of view of the nurses who care for you. What did they learn?" And the next day, you know, "Tell the story from the point of view of what Dad learned when he took you down there." And this would go on and on and on. And one day she said, "Now, Joe, tell the story from the point of view of what you get to do that your brothers and sisters don't get to do." And he kind of lit up because he got to read all day. And they were out in the field plowing and working hard on the farm.
What a brilliant mother. I mean, that is just, you know, to tell the story from so many different voices.
Yeah, the wisdom to do this. And, you know, she said to him, she said, "Now, Joe, if you don't tell the story, that story will sit on top of you for the rest of your life, and you'll be 50 years old, but you'll still be 5 years old inside, and you'll be pitiful. But if you tell the story often enough, you'll be able to crawl out from underneath that story and sit on top of it, and it won't define you anymore. It'll just be a story of something that happened." And that's the way it was for him. And he went on to get a kind of some further education. He became the manager of a wholesale grocery. And one day, the banker in town, there's one bank town with a one-man bank, approached him and wanted to know if he wanted to buy the bank, and he did. And he became, he was known as Cripple Joe. That was his nickname, but he wore that with pride.
With pride, yeah.
But he became Banker Joe. You know, and there were some other Joe Davises in town, so everyone had a nickname. And he became Banker Joe. So so this notion is that, you know, and you think about, you know, all of us know people who've had cancer, for example. You know, and you get a diagnosis like that, it's just devastating. And your narrative has been derailed, in a sense. You know, we have an expectation and life's going to go like this, and then this will happen, and, you know. And suddenly this event happens, and suddenly you're in another story. And there's a lot to grieve about the losses that may be, things that you won't be able to do, or the things that won't be available to you. And then the question is, at some point, okay, what now? What now? What's possible now?
Well, and, you know, it was your telling me that story that made me look at those 10 years, and I'm telling you that just happened in a week, made me look at my 10 years very differently, and I thought, you know, because I've always looked at them sort of embarrassingly and shamefully, and, you know, I could have done differently. And then having looked at the other side, I said, wait a minute, those were a damn good 10 years. You know, there was a... Right. There was a lot of good stuff that happened in there, a lot of bad stuff, but a lot of good stuff that happened as well. And it was that story of you having me tell it, or you having, you know, the mom having the son tell it from different points of view. I looked at different points of view, and that was really helpful. You know, as we, you know, I know it's going to take a little time, so as we wrap up, there's something that I think that I really would like you to tell the story of that I think... Because I have a second interview in mind with you, and we're going to play a game, but we won't do that today. We'll do that another time. But I want us, all of us listeners, to grasp the power of story, not just as an individual that you are the story you tell yourself, but your organization is the story that you tell of the organization. And you told me the story of a master story of you working with a school of troubled students and a difficult mission, and yet somehow you found success. And I think that's a worthy notion for our listeners to hear.
Well, good. Yeah. So I just was in North Carolina working with a number of schools that are labeled alternative schools, and what that means is that the kids who are coming to those schools probably got into all kinds of trouble, so much so that they decided they couldn't stay in the regular school. Either they're drugs or violence. They probably have, probably all of them have some kind of learning challenges, and they're often coming out of intense poverty that's not just like dad lost his job last month, but it's sometimes it's gone on for generations.
And generational poverty, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a tough, you know, they're not dealt a great hand to start with, okay? So, and sometimes organizations, schools like that, can have a very limiting story about what's possible. Both a limiting story about what's possible with the kids that they're serving, and it requires a great deal of skill to work with these kids. And patience and strength and courage, you know, because every day can be very tough. But on the same hand, the school and the teachers may also have a story that, you know, it's a very limiting story. It's not an aspirational story that they're going to change lives. You know, sometimes they're just like holding pins. So one of the things that we're working on with these schools is to help them develop a bigger story, an aspirational story that is filled with possibility. Because, you know, we were talking at the beginning of the interview, we're saying that our stories define us, and stories define organizations. And if they have a story that we can't do much with these kids, you know what, that's what's going to show up. But if they have a story that every kid walking into that school has potential, and it's our job to to figure out what their potential is and where their strengths are and how we can nurture those strengths. And we can set them on a better trajectory to give them some possibilities. That's what's going to show up. You know, years ago there was this pivotal study that was done that you couldn't do any longer because it involved human subjects. And, you know, there's lots of rules around that now. But in the study, they took a classroom of students who were coming in to the new year, and they randomly put them in two groups. And they told the teacher that one of the groups was a low-performing group of students and the other group was high-performing.
And this is random. This is not
it was random. So the kids, you know, some of them, and there were low performers in the high, in that high performing group that was identified as high performing, and there were high performers in the low performing group. But sure enough, by the end of the year, the kids who were labeled high performing were doing terrific, and the kids that were labeled low performing, sure enough, they weren't doing very well. And I mean, you know, so you couldn't do that any longer because you're impacting people's lives in profound ways. But you know, the lesson in that for me is, you know, we essentially behave in ways that we don't even understand to fulfill our expectations. If I expect you to be really high performing, I'm gonna expect things from you, and you know what? I will elicit things from you you didn't even know that you were capable of doing. And if I think that you're a low performer and you don't do too well today, I'll go, oh, well, he's not a very smart kid anyway, so I guess he did the best he could, and I won't set high expectations for you. And you know what? You'll sort of live down to the expectations, the low expectations. So organizations do the same thing. And so it's incumbent upon leaders to, first of all, ask the question, what story are we living in? And is it the best possible story we could be living in? And if it's not, then what story do we want to create that we want to be our aspirational goal? That's constantly the thing that we refer to and asking the question, are we living our story? And if not, what do we need to do to recalibrate, get back on track? And so, you know, organizations are not so different than people. And so it's incumbent upon leaders to be very cognizant of the story that they're living.
You know, I like the word aspirational. And I think there are so many, especially with generational poverty, there is no aspiration. Where do you look for hope? Because all you see is failure, or not failure. You don't see success. And how am I going to do any better than that? And aspiration is so important individually, and then corporately. I see this corporately. You know, you think of TV commercials, which I try to watch as many channels as I can that don't have commercials, but they are stories. And they're trying to give facts, but it's done through some interesting little story. We're nearing our time for a close, and I feel like we have more to go. Would you be willing to do?
Oh.
Because you know what I want to try? You know what I want to play with? In the next show, you know, I filled out some of your exercises.
And I'd love to talk with you about it.
I would love you to walk me through creating my story. And that would be our listeners could be taking notes, and how could they create their story? Because, you know, I have ups
Absolutely.
And downs in my life. And so let's plan. We'll do this offline. We'll plan a next session. And we'll do that soon. We won't plan it long because I want it to be near this session. And we'll plan to get together.
You just let me know, and I'd love to do that with you. Because I think, you know, one of the concepts that I talk about a lot is that we are all called to do something in our lives. And sometimes that's not always clear what that is.
And it doesn't have to be big and huge. We don't have to be Jeff Bezos.
No.
You know, it's just a matter of making a difference in somebody's life.
Yeah, and living, if we understand that we, it doesn't have to be, we all don't have to be Mother Teresa, for example.
Precisely.
So how do we find what's our purpose, our calling in life? And sometimes it's just a little recalibrating, and sometimes it's sometimes it's a discovery and you go, oh my gosh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. For me, it was storytelling, but that was, we don't all get this sort of, hit on the head that kind of wakes us up to something new and different. But I think that when we do find that, we can live more meaningfully and greater sense of purpose and significance. And
oh, that'd be fun. I'll be excited. I'm a curious learner, so that will be really fun for me. So Rick Stone, what an insightful time together, and thank you so much. How does someone get in touch with you for Creating an Exciting Life and Business Story?
Oh, good. Yeah, so they can learn more about the book at storyintelligence.com.
Right. I'll have a link on that in the show notes.
Blogs and videos and lots of resources.
Well, you have my email address. Would you mind sending me those links? And I will post all
Absolutely.
Of those links on our show notes so people can get in touch with you.
Great. Well, thanks
so much, Rick. I know you're off to meditation, but if you could hang on just a sec after the phone call.
Sure will.
I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the show, The Next Chapter with Charlie, and please be sure to check us out at our website where you can get podcasts, weekly podcasts and weekly blogs at thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.